Hey, Luke, we're back.
It's been a while.
But it was time well spent.
Yes, it was. For the sake of our listeners, we should explain what we've been doing. What we've been doing is research. This next season, these next 10 episodes, are about the nature of desire. So Alonzo and I have been catching up on the current literature on the subject from both philosophy and neuroscience.
Yeah, and you're still sending me more stuff to read than a person can have time to read.
You'll find the time.
I'll try. For today, however, I'd like to catch our listeners up by taking a moment to review what happened in Season 1. In Season 1, we told stories about Alf and Betty and used them to present a set of ideas on what desires are and how they relate to each other.
I think that was a good introduction, but of course it was a bit imprecise. Our readers have been asking for more detail and clarity, and I think we should give it to them. Only then will they be able to see whether desireism stands up to criticism or falls in the face of attack.
Attack? Desireism?
You talk like it's your little baby.
Well, yeah, I'm human. When I was in graduate school, I came up with the idea that we can understand morality a lot better if we see it not as a system of right and wrong actions, but as a system of good and bad desires. I'd really like that idea to be worth something. It's not always easy to listen to criticism. That's a danger that honest people have to take seriously, this disposition that people have to blind themselves to flaws in a position that they like. However, like we said in Season 1, I really don't want to present an idea and have people accept it if it's wrong. I don't want to contribute to making things worse for people, even as I tried to make things better. Desireism ultimately needs to be able to stand up to criticism, or it needs to be discarded as just another foolish idea.
Yep. So, let's get into the specifics of desireism. Let's talk about what desireism actually says and how desireism could be proved false.
Sure, but desireism makes a lot of claims. Mm-hmm. It makes claims about desires and intentional action, about praise and condemnation, claims about things like negligence and excuses and moral responsibility, about right and wrong action, just to name a few. These are all claims that might be false. We can't cover them all at once.
Okay, so we break it up into parts. In this next set of episodes that we're calling Season 2, let's look at what is obviously a core concept of desireism, desire.
Yeah.
What is a desire? How does it operate? How do we even know that desires exist? Once we have a grasp of what a desire is, we can move on from there, and then later we can look back and compile the full list of claims that we want to defend.
Well, except I'm betting that before we get too far, we'll be discovering claims that we want to change. Our listeners are going to want to raise questions or objections about some of these claims, and in some cases, they're going to be valid criticisms.
I hope we get some good objections from our listeners. I mean, obviously, we didn't get this theory from God on Mount Sinai. I think it's almost certain there are mistakes somewhere in our thinking about desireism. And it would be useful to have some listeners point out those mistakes.
Yeah, well, I've made a few changes over the years. What's a few more?
You know, before we begin, I do want to make one thing clear. In the next 10 episodes, we'll be discussing some of the leading theories of what desire is, but we have to remember that these are basically theories of what desire is in humans. These are theories about what desire is in a particular species of mammal on a particular speck of dust in a vast universe.
Right. Humans came up with these ideas about beliefs and desires because they needed to be able to explain and predict the behavior of other people, other human beings. Mm-hmm. It's a theory built for that purpose. Mm-hmm. It's an open question at this point whether those ideas have any use outside of that specific need. Heck, it's an open question at this point whether it's the best theory even for serving that need.
And that's fine. I mean, first we're going to explain what our claims are in terms of how desires work in humans, in terms of human psychology. And this will give our audience something they can grab onto because desire in humans is what we're most familiar with, obviously. And later, we're going to revisit these claims and try to show that they work just as well when applied to other possible implementations of desire in animals, aliens, and artificial agents, as you might say.
In other words, we'll eventually argue that this theory does have validity outside of its primary goal of explaining the intentional actions of human agents.
Right. Anyway, let's get started. Let's look back at those earlier episodes where we told stories and made analogies and so on, and let's pull out the exact, precise claims we were trying to make. For example, in episode 3, we told the story about Elf with his one desire to gather stones. If we were to generalize what we said in that episode, I suppose it would be something like this. Desires provide agents with reason to act so as to bring about that which is desired.
Well, we could actually get a bit more technical than that. Mm-hmm. All desires can be expressed in the form of an attitude towards a proposition, whereby the agent seeks to act so as to make or keep true the proposition that is the object of the desire.
Alonzo, I know what you just said because I've been around this subject for a while, but could you please break that up a bit and show us how that all fits together?
That was our project during the first season. In that case, we said that Elf had a desire that he gather stones. This meant that Elf had motivating reason to make or keep true the proposition, quote, Elf is gathering stones, end quote. Mm-hmm. All desires can be expressed in the form of an attitude towards a proposition, such as the proposition, Elf is gathering stones. Another proposition we used in season 1, quote, the moon Pandora continues to exist, end quote. Mm-hmm. A couple of other examples of propositions that can be objects of a desire are, I'm having sex with Penny, or the human race survives for at least several billion years. All desires motivate agents to choose those actions that they believe would make or keep those propositions true.
So what if I can prove that desires, like gods or fairies, don't really exist?
Well, if you can come up with a theory of intentional action that does a better job of predicting and explaining human behavior, and that theory has no room for anything like desires, then you've killed desireism.
Or maybe desires do exist, but they don't work the way that we say they do. Maybe all desires aim for pleasure or happiness or something. That's different than what we've claimed. We've claimed that desires can aim for all kinds of things, like the desire that the moon Pandora continue to exist.
Right. In those types of cases, showing that desireism is wrong will not defeat desireism, but it will require that the theory be modified to some extent. Desireism still works, even if all of us have only one desire, a desire for happiness, for example. But it doesn't work the way we've claimed it does.
So what do you say to this being our first claim? Beliefs and desires exist as propositional attitudes. That is to say, they are mental states that constitute an attitude towards a proposition.
I'd have to make one slight change. Remember, we had to distinguish between desires as ends and desires as means. Means are the useful tools for getting what one ultimately wants, while ends are what one ultimately wants. Mm-hmm. So a desire as end is a desire for something as an end, not as a means to something else that is desired. Using that distinction, it would be more precise to say, claim number one, beliefs and desires as ends exist as propositional attitudes.
Okay. Now, more specifically, what is a belief?
Well, that's our second claim. Claim number two, a belief is an attitude towards a proposition that takes the proposition to be true. So the statement, I believe that there is some chocolate cake in the kitchen, says, I have a mental attitude towards the proposition, there is some chocolate cake in the kitchen, that takes that proposition to be true.
Okay, and how does that differ from a desire?
Well, we'll make that our third claim. Claim number three, a desire as end is an attitude towards a proposition that causes an agent to seek to create or preserve states of affairs in which that proposition is true. So, the statement, I desire that I am eating a chocolate cake, says, I have a mental attitude towards the proposition I am eating a chocolate cake that causes me to seek to make the proposition true, or keep it true if I'm already eating a chocolate cake. Mm-hmm. In other words, it says, get up off your duff, you lazy oaf, and get yourself some chocolate cake. If I'm eating chocolate cake, but I have had my fill, I'd say I don't want any more. Or more technically, I no longer have a desire that I am eating chocolate cake. I no longer seek to keep true the proposition I am eating chocolate cake.
And we might be wrong about those claims. Lots of philosophers think that these claims are false. They say that beliefs and desires are other types of things, or that beliefs and desires don't mm-hmm. exist at all. In fact, there isn't really any consensus right now. There are quite a few theories of belief and desire that are serious contenders.
There isn't a consensus over which theory would turn out to be correct. But there is a leading view, or a standard view, and that's the view we're defending here. The standard view is that there are brain states, beliefs and desires, and that they explain our intentional actions. An agent acts a particular way because he has desires for particular ends and beliefs that pick out the means for realizing those ends. Mm. I desire to eat chocolate cake. I believe that there is some chocolate cake in the kitchen. I get up and go to the kitchen so that I can make true the proposition I am eating chocolate cake.
It sounds to me like you're adding another claim here. Claim number 4, intentional actions are best explained in terms of an agent's beliefs and desires.
Well, that's how the standard view goes.
Okay, but Alonzo, I don't go to the kitchen every time that I want some cake and believe that there is cake in the kitchen. So I don't always seek to make or keep true the propositions that are the objects of my desires. What's going on there?
Well, that's because you have a whole slew of desires, not just a desire for chocolate cake. Some of those desires are telling you to stay on the couch. You might be comfortable sitting on the couch and want to stay there. If that's true, fulfilling the most and strongest of your desires could mean staying on the couch. However, in that case, if somebody were to bring you a slice of chocolate cake, you'd eat it.
But not if I had an even stronger desire to have six-pack abs for the ladies, I suppose.
Well, yeah, that's true. Which brings me to claim number 5. An agent chooses to act so as to fulfill the most and strongest of the agent's desires as ends, given the agent's active beliefs. Which means that even if you want chocolate cake, but you want to impress the ladies with your ripped figure even more, your belief that there is chocolate cake in the kitchen will not motivate you to get any. This is because you also have a belief that having the cake will contribute to making you fat, and that would thwart your stronger desire to impress the ladies. You're acting so as to fulfill the most and strongest of your desires.
Given my active beliefs.
Well, sure. You act as if the things that you believe are actually true. As if your beliefs are an accurate model of the world. Remember, a belief is an attitude that a proposition is true. If you desire to eat some chocolate cake and believe that there is some chocolate cake in the kitchen, assuming you had no competing desires, you are motivated to go to the kitchen for some cake. But what if you're wrong? What if there is no chocolate cake in the kitchen? You don't know this. So you're still motivated to go to the kitchen for some chocolate cake. Ultimately, this won't fulfill your desire for chocolate cake, but you don't act so as to fulfill your desire for chocolate cake. You act to fulfill your desire for chocolate cake in a world in which your beliefs are true and complete.
Okay, but you said active beliefs. Does that mean there's another kind of belief called an inactive belief?
Well, it sure looks that way. We need to speak about active beliefs to account for those times when something slips your mind, when you forget something. Certainly this has happened to you. You're getting ready to go someplace. You fix yourself some coffee to drink along the way. You put it in a cup with a safety lid on it so it won't spill, and you set it on the table. Then you go and do something else for a minute, and when you leave the coffee cup on the table. It's still there. You don't even think about it until you get a mile or two down the road. Now, you didn't stop believing that the coffee was on the table. If somebody asks, where is your coffee, you know exactly where you left it. It isn't something you need to learn. It's just something you need to remember. An inactive belief is sitting there in the back of your mind waiting to be recalled, and it doesn't influence intentional action until it is recalled.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, next, there's another fact about desires that's important to desireism that doesn't actually get talked about much. It'll turn out to be important that many desires as ends don't change very quickly. In other words, claim number 6, many desires as ends are persistent.
Persistent? What do you mean by that?
Persistent, like my nephew when he wants a cookie. He won't leave me alone. He just won't go away. Well, a desire's end is usually going to stick around. If you hate spinach today, then chances are good that you'll hate spinach tomorrow. You can't just suddenly like spinach for an hour because your mother-in-law is serving a spinach souffle and then go back to hating spinach after dinner.
But Alonzo, think about this. Let's say I desire to drink what is in the glass in front of me. And then you tell me the glass isn't full of water, it's full of antifreeze. Well, my desire to drink that liquid in the glass will disappear immediately.
Your desire as means to drink what is in the glass will disappear immediately. Your desire as end, to satisfy your thirst, is persistent. You're still thirsty. You simply came to realize that drinking the contents of the glass will not fulfill your desires and to quench your thirst. Or you realize that drinking the liquid will thwart more and stronger desires than not drinking the liquid. Desires as means are combinations of desires as ends and beliefs. Your desire as means to drink the contents of the glass is a combination of your thirst, which is a desire as end, and your belief that the contents of the glass will quench your thirst. If you change that belief, and beliefs can change in an instant like that, then your desire as means to drink the contents of the glass changes in an instant as well. However, your desire as end doesn't change so easily.
Is that another claim? Desires as means are combinations of desires as ends and beliefs?
Oh, sure. We'll throw that one in there. Claim number 7. In addition to desires as ends, there are desires as means. Desires for states that, given one's active beliefs, will lead to the fulfillment of an end. Desires as means are constituted by desires as ends and beliefs.
So when my belief that the glass contains water changes in an instant, then my desire as means to drink what was in the glass changes too. But my desire as end, my thirst, does not go away. I start looking for something else to drink, something I think is good, clean water.
Right.
Okay, and I would like to add a claim that David Hume is famous for, that reason is the slave of the passions.
Well, I certainly accept that. You can't deduce a new desire as end from reason alone. There's no set of premises that doesn't already include a desire as end somewhere within them that entails a new desire as its conclusion. So, claim number 8. There is no valid argument that contains a desire in the conclusion that does not contain a desire in the premises.
Right, or this is how the philosopher Neil Sinibabu puts it, quote, desires can be changed as the conclusion of reasoning only if a desire is among the premises of the reasoning, end quote. The example I use to explain this is to think about the person who is argued into becoming a vegan. That looks like reason alone led her to change her desires as ends, but I don't think that's what happened. Instead, the argument convinced her that becoming vegan is the best way to fulfill other desires she already has. For example, her desires for animal welfare. There are no desires that are quote-unquote rational, except in that they can be rational in relation to other desires you already have. You can't get from reason alone to desires as ends. You can't get there from here. As Hume said, 'tis not contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the whole world to the scratching of my finger.
Yeah, I find it interesting that Hume gets all the credit for this. However, we can find the same thing even in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Quote, we deliberate not about ends, but about means. For a doctor does not deliberate whether he shall heal, nor an orator whether he shall persuade. They assume the end and consider how and by what means it is attained, and if it seems easily and best produced thereby.
So you can't change what an agent desires as an end by changing their beliefs or by reasoning with them. But you can change what an agent does by changing their beliefs. Changing their beliefs changes their desires as means, even if it doesn't change their desires as ends.
Well, sure. If intentional action really is a consequence of beliefs and desires as ends, then if you want somebody to act differently, one way to do that is to change their beliefs. Another is to change their desires as ends. Claim number 9. To change an agent's intentional actions, you need to change the agent's beliefs, or the agent's desires as ends, or both.
Right. My intention to go to the kitchen is premised on my desire to eat chocolate cake, and my belief that there is chocolate cake in the kitchen. If Sally wants to get me to choose some other course of action, to go to the bedroom instead of the kitchen, for example, she can do so by making me believe there is chocolate cake in the bedroom instead of in the kitchen, or by making me believe that something even better than eating chocolate cake will happen if I go to the bedroom.
Or she can change your desires so that you no longer desire chocolate cake, for example.
Well, but Alonzo, why are we talking about changing people's desires as ends? We already said that you can't reason somebody into changing those types of desires.
Well, we can't change a person's desires as ends by means of reason alone. That doesn't imply that we can't change desires as ends. Let me add claim number 10. Praise, condemnation, reward, and punishment can, in many cases, change, that is, weaken or strengthen, desires as ends. Now, I'm not talking about how promising a reward or punishment can change people's behavior by giving them new beliefs, beliefs that they will earn a reward or receive a punishment. Instead, what I'm talking about is something psychologists have found. They found that rewarding or punishing someone can actually change their desires. Parents already know this. They use reward and punishment not only to change how their children behave today, but also to change what the children genuinely want to do in the future, or when the parent isn't around to monitor them.
Mm-hmm.
Parents use praise and condemnation in the hope that their kids will come to have certain desires. For example, desires to be kind to people and to succeed in life through hard work and creativity.
But praise and condemnation don't instantly change what people desire as an end. I mean, sometimes praise and condemnation doesn't have any effect at all.
Exactly. That's what we said before. Desires as ends are persistent. They are not easily changed. But they can still be changed. Well, some of them can.
You know, Alonzo, it seems to me that this last claim actually belongs in a different category from the first 9 claims.
How's that?
Well, as we went through these claims, I kept asking myself how each one would apply to animals, for example, or to an alien civilization, or to an artificial agent, if we actually get an artificial agent that is that sophisticated. The first 9 claims all seem to be things that we would have to apply to animals, aliens, and artificial agents, as well as to humans.
Yeah.
But we humans might be the only creatures wired to respond to praise and condemnation the way that we do. Well, maybe some animals as well. I mean, it always seemed like my dog responded to condemnation, but we might not find anything like that in aliens or artificial agents.
So what are you saying?
Well, just that I want to make this distinction. I think I can argue later that the first 9 claims apply to animals, aliens, and artificial agents as well as to humans. But I'm not so sure about the 10th one. That one might be specific to certain kinds of creatures like highly social primates that developed sophisticated language capacities, for example.
Okay, that's noted.
But let's not get into that right now. For now, let's focus on whether these 10 claims are true of humans. There is some controversy surrounding all of these claims, and any of them could be false. And if somebody wants to falsify desireism, or at least force a major revision of the theory, then they can do that by showing that one or more of these claims is false.
I agree that even though I think these claims are true, they're not obviously true. A great many good thinkers will raise objections against them.
Mm-hmm.
We want to look at these claims and look at what reasons exist for thinking they're true and what reasons exist for thinking they're false.
Right. And that's what we want to explore next. What do today's leading philosophers and scientists say about these claims?
So, Luke, same place, same time next week?
Same place, same time.